This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Don't just ride the index, seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God. This is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, starting May 8th, wherever you get your podcasts.
How big an issue was equal prize money to you?
I always thought, even when I played, it seems like we were being overpaid. And then people would tell me, like in the 90s, no, you have no idea. We're only making this percentage of total, you know, revenue. And in other sports, they make this percentage. And it would blow my mind. But I came up with not a lot. And, you know, at 16, I started making more than my dad. So it was all overwhelming to me. And then once I got to spend time with Billy, she was the first one that really taught me all about quality and what to strive for with women and what we've been up against through the course of history.
Hey everyone, John Wertheim here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast, Beyond the Baseline. We were away on vacation last week, but now we're back. Obviously, a lot has happened since our last discussion. Who better to survey the landscape of tennis with than Lindsay Davenport? Former number one player, three-time Grand Slam champion, Hall of Famer, commentator, mom, wife, but also very honest broker and a great person to sort of take inventory of tennis. So we're going to talk about a lot of topics here on this podcast. We're going to jump around, but that's in keeping with our attempts to keep this conversational and unscripted and loose-fitting. So let's bring her in. The great Lindsay Davenport is back. Welcome again.
Hello, Mr. Wertheim.
You are reflexively, pathologically even modest, so you're going to roll your eyes even though we can't see you. But I'm telling you, on social media and email, people are always saying, when are you bringing Lindsay back? She's got to be on more often. So you've made a lot
of people
happy.
You know I don't believe you, so you don't even have to say that.
I will show you. People are going to... I'm forwarding you tweets. So anyway, thanks for coming back.
Anything for you.
So I figured we would, it's been a weird couple weeks. I figured we would ease into things. So I'll start you out with a softball. What the hell's going on in tennis? When did this sport turn into to crazy land?
I know, right? I mean, these first
90 days have been interesting.
Yeah, these first 3 months, you almost want to just like semi-erase and say, can we do a do-over?
But first ball in.
It is where we are, but I don't know. I keep thinking, okay, it can only get better from here, right? Better stories, more positive outcomes. You know, and even when we thought we were, like, going that way, Roger's coming back early in Miami, he's going to be back playing, and then he can't. So I don't know. It just seems like there's a lot of chaos right now in the sport, and these are the times when I think, okay, it would be better if we had one leader leading both the men and the women players, and we're able to navigate through this together.
That's a really good point.
I think we need no more controversies for the next few months.
I feel like you sort of have a strange role in this. So you're a former player, obviously, and you've done some coaching, and yet you're kind of a straight shooter on the air. You're very much a straight shooter on the air. Do you see yourself as journalist, as former player? I mean, if you're in my shoes, you kind of don't care, and the news is the news, and you report on it, and in some weird kind of way, Maria Sharapova, you know, failing a drug test is actually, you know, it's something you write about. It changes things up. It's unexpected. Where do you sort of see yourself in reporting all this?
I think the first few years, right when I stopped, I know that I was really conscious of, oh, I know so many people that are still playing, or I know this person, and I don't want to say anything. And then I think as the years go by, you get more detached, and you start seeing, I started seeing my role as, you're supposed to go on there and say, I'm being paid to say my opinions and my outlook on things. And I just think the years go by, you just get more, why wouldn't I say what I feel? I'm amazed at how much jockeying goes on behind the scenes to get people in our positions to not say their true feelings.
Oh,
like, we've had these meetings and we're like, oh my gosh, are you, but.
Wait, you're talking story. About, so, you're talking about from agents saying, I wish you wouldn't say this, from the tour.
It comes from even more than agents. You know, it comes from all over, and
right.
That's when we get into it. It is a very small niche sport, but there are times when it's like, okay, you know, this person called, we're not supposed to say this, and you're like, what are you talking about? So I don't know. I don't believe in any of that.
How much do you fear the other side, though? So Chris Evert, you know, we're going to, you and I will talk candidly as we always do, and if we get in trouble, we get in trouble. But, you know, so Chris Evert gets asked about Djokovic's comments, and she makes a remark that a lot of people took issue with, how there were cultural differences, and the U.S. is so far ahead of Europe in terms of gender issues, which I think some people looked at with a cocked eye. But, you know, she got beat up pretty good for that. How much do you fear that you're going to say something and you're going to say to yourself, shit, if I had just taken the path down the middle and played it straight, I wouldn't have to deal with this kind of backlash? I mean, how much do you feel, how much do you fear saying something that's going to turn into this cause celeb?
Yeah, that is kind of like your biggest nightmare, right? Where you do say something and then it gets taken. You know, people want to misconstrue stuff if they're not a fan or they don't like. Everyone in this day and age is looking at something to put someone down with or use it against them. So you kind of have to have a thick skin when you agree to go into this kind of role or this kind of job where you're putting your opinions out on the line. And that was a perfect example where I believe Chris was talking about in prize money. The U.S. Open was the first, and we're more accustomed to in this country, in this sport, of striving to be equal. And then that got taken. It was more of a cultural thing. So, I mean, who knows? But sometimes I do. I will never, and lucky this isn't my job, talk about politics. I don't say a word on that subject.
You feeling
ever.
The burn? No, there are a number of third rails, and you expect some backlash. But, yeah, I mean, I even, let's sort of transition here. What Ray Moore said was indefensible. His choice of words was horrific. I mean, you cringe when you read it. There's no way it could have been taken out of context. All of that said, I do feel like here's this guy in his late 60s who 2 weeks ago you would have said, oh, yeah, he's an old South African player, runs Indian Wells, seems like a nice enough guy. And now this guy's like Jimmy the Greek. I mean, I can't imagine what he's going to do to reverse his legacy. And it was a really, really bad choice of words that he used, but It was one bad morning, and this guy's completely rewritten how he's going to be recalled. That to
yeah.
me is a little spooky.
You know, it definitely, and it's like wildfire now. If you say anything that can be taken anyway, it's everywhere in a heartbeat. For those of us that don't know Ray well, and surprisingly, even though he's a tournament director at Indian Wells, I've had very minimal contact with the guy my whole life, and I think he even lives like 10 or 15 minutes from me. So then you read those comments and you don't know him, you take him more the wrong way. Then you talk to some people in the sport and everything that he's done over the years. You know, Billie Jean King, I had a conversation with her where she was trying to explain exactly what he's meant to the sport and the history, and he made a mistake. It's fine. I just after hearing those comments, it was like, well, he can't run a women's tournament.
Right.
But if guys choose to keep him on as the men's tournament director, so be it. But you can't possibly have a guy who even says those comments or thinks that. And there are a lot of people in our sport that think those comments. They might not say them publicly, but they, you know, women's tennis is, people love to kind of make jokes about it or put it down, even those in the sport. You know, no problem, but then don't go try and be involved in women's tennis.
Right. No, that was, you and I know
that
that's the dirty secret.
That was my first thing when I read
those. Really,
I'm like, well, whatever they want to do with him in the tournament, get him out of women's tennis.
That's a really good point. The other thing, too, is you don't make those kinds of remarks if you think you're a lone wolf who feels this way. I mean, clearly this is a version of a speech that he's given and heard many times within tennis.
And we've all heard it many times. People say it, like, in back rooms or wherever in certain meetings. But then, like I said, don't try and do anything leading women's tennis or being involved in women's tennis.
How big an issue was equal prize money to you?
You know, it was so funny because I always thought, even when I played, like, I can't believe it seems like we were being overpaid. And then people would tell me, like, in the 90s, no, you have no idea. You're like, we're only making this percentage of total, you know, revenue. And in other sports, they make this percentage. And it would blow my mind. But I came up with not a lot. And, you know, at 16, I started making more than my dad the first year I turned pro. So it was all overwhelming to me. And then once I got to spend time with Billy on a, not a weekly basis, but for, I don't know, 4 to 6 weeks a year with Fed Cup and other stuff, then you really, she was the first one that really taught me all about equality and what to strive for with women and what we've been up against through the course of history. I do thank my lucky stars that she was the Fed Cup captain for the majority of my career.
And now it seems to me you can't go back. I mean, you have equal prize money. You can't say, yep, you know what, the ATP's got a little more in sponsorships and they've got a little doodad on the net. We've got to go back to, 55-45, 60-40.
Right. It's crazy. I mean, it's been amazing that the conversation that it's brought up with women's soccer, and I don't profess to know all the facts about it. I was reading articles last night in bed, but it's like, good for them. You know, that it should be the case if you can, you know, if people love to argue it's a business, it's this, it's that. There's stuff that goes on behind the scenes that does make it hard for women to earn equal money in regular jobs. And that's the kind of stuff that Billy was so instrumental in teaching me about, showing me about in my late teens, early 20s.
It also, I mean, it seems to me in tennis too, it's unique in that you're playing simultaneously, that Azarenka walks off the court and there's Rafa ready to go on. I mean, the women's soccer is a little different in the sense that you've got, they're not, literally not a same playing field.
Right.
I mean, the tennis, when everybody's sort of changing sessions and, hey, the Kerber match went long, so Kyrgios is going to move to the grandstand.
Right.
It seems to me when everybody's sort of at the same place, playing on the same day simultaneously, and TV's going back and forth, it's very hard to start kind of counting nickels. But
yeah,
listen
exactly.
To you. This is you are the Orange County feminist. hey, two detours real quick. You mentioned prize money. I got a practical question for you.
Okay.
How does that work? And I've never actually. How does it work just practically? I mean, so Azarenka will. We're doing this on a Friday. Azarenka has a chance to go back to back on these U.S. hardcourt events, Indian Wells and Miami. That's a lot of, you know, it's $2 million plus. How does that work practically? I mean, does the agent then send her the prize money? Does it get direct deposit in a bank? Is there some fund?
That's
where
so
she
funny.
Can...
I think every player does it differently, and I'm sure it wouldn't shock you to know that I went in to get my prize money every single time by myself.
Where's my money?
In my day, though, we used to get checks. And in my career, I only lost one of them. But now you just go in with your wire instructions and they wire it. I would imagine that a high percentage of players have their agents go in and do it for them. I do think it's a big deal that players start to take, you know, advantage, start to learn the ropes with that and have an idea of where their money goes and what it's about. But I also understand that some players just don't care, don't know, and that's why you see some players after their career, I think, have a hard time with finances.
It's a very weird, I mean, you know, most people obviously, you know, you get paid every other week and the money gets direct deposited, and other, you know, you star in a movie and there's a payout schedule. It must be very weird to be like, you know, this week I made $8,500, next week I made $72,000, and it's
right.
Just...
Or a million, right?
Yeah,
if
well,
Azarenka wins again, yeah, it's crazy. And, you know, it's only a certain percentage that of players that make money that is so off the charts, you kind of giggle about it, but that is their reality, and Lord knows, I have no idea what they would do with $2 million.
That's a good month. But is it taxed out on the spot?
Yeah, most countries take it out when you go in there. I mean, I know in Australia, it's almost like if you do decent, it's like 50% off the top. You try and recoup some in expenses. And then for Americans, and we come back, and for us really smart California residents that have another, 10 or 11%.
You get no sympathy.
As well as federal.
You're talking to a New York resident.
Some of that money back. You certainly don't leave Australia or Indian Wells with, you know, $1.2 million. That's a lot out for taxes.
But it's not like Azarenka's going in there and walking out with fat wads of cash and a racket.
No, definitely not.
Come on, you were about to say something. Who took it in cash? Come on.
I did get paid in cash, but this was like 94 and it was it wasn't that much, but that one tournament did pay a little bit in cash.
What a strange existence, if I'm allowed to say that.
I just wrote out some goals and stuff. I wanted to get drafted as high as I can. I mean, the draft's coming up. We'll see.
After the regular season, after the bowl season, there is another season, draft season. As soon as the confetti rains down on the NCAA champion, a crop of college football players officially become NFL prospects. These players' new goal is to convince 32 NFL front offices that they cannot be missed. The road to the pros isn't the same for everyone. There are stars derailed by injury.
His season is over following surgery to repair a torn meniscus in his right knee.
Blue chip talents overshadowed by red flags.
Yeah, it was like, yo, we're going to this party. Let's pop this before we go. And I thought, well, everybody else here is doing it, I guess I can do it.
QBs trying to prove they can become the face of an NFL franchise.
Just tune out the noise and just really focus in on doing what you need to do to be the most prepared you can.
I'm Ben Glicksman, and over the coming weeks, Sports Illustrated's team of reporters will give you a behind-the-scenes look into one of the craziest and most compelling events in sports. The draft goes deeper than 7 rounds. Each pick is a player. Each player has a story. Get ready. It's draft season. To subscribe to this podcast, search for Draft Season on iTunes or find it at si.com/draftseason.
Hey, here's another random one for you. You know, you saw Andy Murray in the men's balls versus women's balls?
Yeah.
I must have had 25 people write to me and saying, who knew? How come no one talks about this? As if this were a conspiracy.
Here's the thing. I don't think, and I could be wrong because I was calling that match, I don't think he played a point with the ball. I think what happened is the ball kid threw it to him and he got really ticked off and noticed it. But I could be wrong, but that was the impression that I got. Now, at the U.S. Open in Miami, those are the two combined events. It might be one in the summer, it might be Cincinnati as well, that use two different balls for the men and women. It's very noticeable on them. The women's always has red writing. The men's is always in black.
Is it a different ball? I mean, is it different compression?
The women's is lighter. There's no question about that. And so if you go on a practice court in Miami, a lot of times players that aren't that clean leave their stuff all around, and there would be balls everywhere. And I would go through them before practice and take out all the men's balls. But it's very noticeable. I think he was very frustrated that the ball kids were throwing in incorrect balls and just picking up whatever balls they saw. And how could they not know the difference? That was my interpretation. I never got the sense that Andy Murray, who's serving and looks methodically at the balls before he bounces them and chooses a ball, he knew immediately he was thrown a women's ball. Like I said, I don't think he played the point with it, but I think he was just frustrated that it was put in the six balls in play.
We had Brad Gilbert on a few weeks ago. Let's stick with Murray for a second. We had Brad Gilbert on a few weeks ago. We were talking about how he seems like a pretty reasonable guy. You see him in the players' lounge, very friendly. And then he gets on the court, and it's like beer face. Like he just yeah. turns into this maniac.
Yeah.
Did you have that where you were just unrecognizable while you played?
Sometimes, yeah. And sometimes the easiest people to take that frustration out is your camp. And for me, it would manifest when I was really tired. Certainly not at the level, I don't think, as Murray. I don't think I would have a husband.
You're giving me nothing, John Leach. Nothing.
I mean, it was crazy, the match. A first match for him, so I guess it was second round because he had a bye,
right.
And he's winning, and he starts just looking up out of nowhere, and 2-1 or 2-2 in the second set, and just going after the camp that is far from the court. And he was telling them to go home. I have to say, at certain times, I don't understand it. I understand it more like quarterfinals, 4-4 in the fourth, and he's tense. I don't understand it up a set, 1-1, first match in Miami, searching them out to berate them.
Well, even the chair. I mean, I remember Andy, you know, I would say that he's, you and I are sufficiently friendly with him that we don't feel like I'm taking, you know, Andy Roddick would do the same thing. And just, he would have these arguments. It's like, come on, you're smarter than that. And he would just have these arguments in the middle of a match and scream at the chair. And the chair is in the position, unlike the camp, where the chair actually has to sort of respond and acknowledge there's a conversation going on.
Yeah.
And then the match is over and it's like, oh yeah, sorry, I kind of lost it out there. I don't know what.
Yeah, it is super high stress, high intensity. You know, Novak's dad, did you read that article he did like 2 weeks ago or something where revealing, and
right.
It was fascinating to me. He said, well, Andy's so good, but the difference is he can't hold it together
right.
in a tense moment,
right.
and he loses so much energy because of that. And that's a kind of a real insight to Novak. You'll see Novak snap briefly in some matches, but it's like he gets like zen on the changeovers and he's able to just come right back like it's the first game of the match. That someone who has that in them where they get a little angsty on court and is able to regroup in that situation, that is like amazingly impressive.
I just don't, I mean, it's this is why athletes are athletes, and, you know, I'm not one of them and you are, but can Andy Murray not just tell himself, uh-oh, the rage is starting to bubble, I need to change my behavior and take a deep breath? I mean, the fact that the guy's pushing 30 years old and still has these sort of lapses in the match, and he knows at some rational level that he's behaving erratically and can't stop it, to me, is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it is, and it doesn't matter who's there, right? We thought, okay, last year he must be really unhappy with Bjorkman because he seemed to be doing it more than normal.
Right.
And then Jamie Delgado comes in January, and it was the worst I'd seen at Miami. And yelling, go home, like, I don't get it. And Maresmo even moved out of that situation and sat on her own somewhere. So they're obviously trying to figure it out and work through it. But
I remember Leighton Hewitt screaming in his box because somebody had sat in a different seat than they had the previous match. That he knew the seating chart, and somebody was, you know, one to the left of the mom. And it for three games, that was more important than hitting the ball over the net.
Yeah,
tennis.
We're crazy. We're all crazy.
That's why we love this sport. Let's do a brief Maria detour, though. I don't know what there is. I don't really know if there's a whole lot to add. You know, this was already we're about a month out. Are you hearing anything in terms of procedure?
Not a word. there was obviously in the week or two after the admission, like a heavy kind of pro Maria PR campaign to get
a lot more
positive stories going
by
out about it, and people arguing about the drug, if it's how useful it is. And but now it's just kind of gone radio silent. And I don't think we'll know until the hearing's over, which I'm not sure we'll know when it's happening. I think we'll just hear when we hear what her suspension or non-suspension is.
I mean, you know, I don't know. I think you and I had both heard that she'd been practicing on clay, which was perhaps optimistic. And I don't know. Apparently, she was on vacation with Chelsea Handler at one point. But this is, to me, you're absolutely right. For 2 weeks, this was a daily sort of update, and here was a positive story. And if you have any more questions, please contact. So, and the last 2 weeks have gone pretty dark.
Really dark. Like we had a bunch. We were inundated with kind of info on the drug and this, and then it was like, oh, well, she only took this dose, And then, oh, but the case is confidential. I'm like, well, that's weird.
We're not going to try this.
But you're like offering out other info. The whole thing just got too much. I'm happy it's kind of quieted down, and it will run its course, and we'll see what ends up happening with the decision.
Can you tell people how? I mean, I think one part of this that's I don't want to say critical, but fairly important is whether or not she listed this meldonium on various forms. Can you tell people how these forms work? Where, you know, I think that, one of our colleagues was saying, look, if I took a muscle relaxer before a flight, I would put it on a form.
Of course, and that to me is kind of the key to all of this, and that's the stuff we'll never know. The ITF will never release dosage. They'll never release, you know, former paperwork. They'll just come out with their decision, or WADA, and this is what it is. They don't fight their case publicly. So anyone accused of doping, they can say actually whatever they want. They could say it's wrong. They can say this, because no one will ever come out and fight against them. To me, the big thing is if she declared it. And I'm sure if you take anything, if you take Advil, if you take something stronger, if you take an antibiotic, I know that I had to go, I did all the searching for birth control, because there was one birth control that had a banned substance. Like you're crazy about that.
Right, right.
So even if she had been taking it for a few years, absolutely that's a huge deal if that was on her January form at the Australian Open. If she listed it, how often you take it, the dosage, and that's not something you forget as a player. That's one of the things you're most concerned about. So it would be, and then there would be a history. You can maybe say, oh, I forgot this one tournament. Well, then it would be on her records the last 10 years every time she took it.
That to me is
what's
just
so baffling.
But
that's something we'll never know. But that's going to either help her case a ton, which it should, because if she was taking it, she should have been writing down she was taking it, or that's something that could really hurt her.
Well, that's why I think the camp may have misplayed their hand with. I mean, she probably gave up more information than she had to at that initial press conference. If she had just said, look, I'd been taking this for personal reasons. But once she starts saying it's for X, Y, and Z, people start picking that apart. And then once the dosage got out there, then you say, okay, you're going to traffic in this level of specifics about that. How come you're not answering the questions when people want to know simply if you put it on a form?
Well, that's just it. In the one conference call, the lawyer said, oh, the dosage was really low. And I think he even gave a number. And then it was like, did she put it on her form? Oh, I can't go into specifics of the case.
That's like, dude, you just did.
Those of us on the phone were like, that's weird. But that's to me, that's a big deal. And I'm sure it'll be a big deal to those involved in the case. And again, if she wrote it down, then I think she has a very, very strong case. If she didn't declare it, then there's even more questions. Well, why wouldn't you declare it? So we'll see what ends up happening.
You know, someone said, oh, it's very messy and it's very complicated. And I'm thinking, like, it always is. Nobody says, yes, I took this. What's my suspension? Like, there's always a set of mitigating circumstances, and whether it's Cilic and Troisky, I mean, just go down, not even, you know, even go beyond tennis. I mean, these cases are always messy and complicated.
Really
nobody says, like, oh, you got me, I'm busted, or actually our test was screwed up and you're exonerated. I mean,
I think, and it's funny, because I think that I don't know enough about that drug. It does seem weird that whatever 120 athletes have tested positive for it this year, and most of them are Russian.
It's a lot of low magnesium.
You can fight about, you know, oh, well, they didn't tell us clear enough. They come back and say there was four or five. I mean, who knows all of that stuff? I do know whatever doctor she was getting it from. I just can't see her with that fine oiled machine and such a perfect business. How could she have a doctor
that isn't following those rules
and doesn't know? That's the part that it's like, that's so weird for someone who's so professional about everything.
So buttoned up, right? I mean,
yeah.
I just don't know where. I mean, if she were taking this for not legitimate reasons, she would have quit. And if she was taking this for therapeutic reasons, she would have sought an exemption. The fact that just nothing happened is just a baffling breakdown to me.
I think that's the part that it will always be so weird about a player that is so professional about everything. How she allots her time, how hard she works in practice, how much she's so professional with the media and with sponsors. That just seems like it's so out of character.
In the year 2000... Let me see. You won the Australian Open that year, I think. You're ranked number one. How many players in the top 50, your competitors, do you think are either doping or seeking not legitimate performance enhancing advantages?
I was super naive about the percentages, but I think there was definitely some players, but the percentage, I think it was probably easier to dope back in the 90s, and gosh, I don't know.
But was this something that was sort of persistently on your mind, or
no? Just... Never when I was playing, because I was an idiot.
But then you retired, and you said her, and her. I can't believe.
Well, no. In the mid 2000 years, it was like it started to hit me more. Where I was all of a sudden, I'm like, what? She looks like a completely different person, or wow, that player doesn't get tired anymore. Or it started to click in. I think maybe when I got older or more aware of things, or probably when I started training harder. And was trying so hard to like get fit and get faster, and you know, two steps forward, one step back, two steps forward. I couldn't walk like on Wednesdays after Monday and Tuesday. It was like a struggle to go out and practice. And then you'd see other players like, how are you able to do this for 8 hours and still come back again the next day?
Right.
You know, and some people's body types are totally different. I get all that. But then I started, I think, to get a little bit more annoyed at the situation. And then you start doing more research and. You find out, oh, well, the people that invent the drugs, they're a couple years ahead of the people testing for drugs. And
right.
I'm like, oh, my gosh. Then you start really getting annoyed when you're clean.
What about now? Top 50?
It's such a gamble because in this sport, truly, as the rules state, it's 2 to 4 years. Even,
right.
You know, and we've heard stories of players getting off for less for fighting for whatever they didn't know and this and that. But it just floors me that they take that big of risk. But it's definitely out there. I don't know the percentage, but it definitely happens. I mean, look at Lance Armstrong, never failed a test. And
yeah, well, yeah, Marion Jones, Barry Bonds, they're all, they can all
crazy.
Say this, right?
Yeah.
I would say we'll move on. I would say if I'm Maria, I'm more pissed than anyone at Marion Jones and Lance Armstrong and Barry Bonds, because they've created this climate of skepticism, and it's not haters on social media, and it's not the conventional media. Like, there's a track record of athletes denying, and then later learning those denials are false. I mean, that to me is sort of where a lot of the skepticism comes from.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, gosh, it's just she's always been, you know, she doesn't strike you as a player. I don't know what this drug supposedly does. I guess it helped with stamina and like, what was it? The soldiers last longer. I mean, you look at her and she's not like the craziest looking athlete out there. She's not
But I think we've moved on.
Muscles are bulging and this and that.
Right.
And, she knew it was illegal. She starting this year, she wouldn't have been taking it. But I don't know. We'll see. It's so confounding.
I am. I mean, 10 years ago, I wrote these things. I'm embarrassed that are out there saying like, oh, how many tennis players look like they have big muscle? You know, we've moved beyond sort of East German steroids
yeah,
to, all right, let's move on. Actually, I got some speed round for you.
Okay.
I haven't written anything down, but I'll just, what's Victoria Azarenka ranked right now? I don't mean numerically. No, I mean, I'm saying never mind her ranking. What is she? She's top three player right now.
Jesus, she's like one right now.
That's what
I mean. For this year, she's been far and away the best WTA player. She had one so-so match, and that's it. And that was the quarterfinals of the Australian Open. Or she could very well be undefeated for the year.
What are we making of Serena?
I not too much. I think it's whenever she decides that she is going to go back to committing herself to being the best in the world and not being on the inside. I think that not winning the slam broke her emotionally, or for the last 6 months, it's hard. I think she probably put her heart and soul into winning the U.S. Open. That didn't happen. And that doesn't happen often for her. Let's face it, when you have that many grand slams, you're pretty much, and she's always had this amazing ability, even in matches, to just be like, okay, I want to win now. I don't care. I'm down a set in 4-1. I want
to
win now.
Switch.
So it's going to happen. So I just think that she's going through this still recovering from just a major professional disappointment. I could be wrong, but that's just my take on it. She doesn't look super happy to be playing. A couple practices that we saw, she didn't look super happy out on the court, wasn't really moving. So unless she's injured, I think she's just still, like, heart is broken from not being able to do that.
Man, it was Labor Day week. You know, that was a long time ago.
I know.
Muguruza, Kerber, your former charge, Madison Keys. Who's going to Holop? Who's going to fill this vacuum, and who are you really worried about?
I was super worried about Muguruza. I always say Muguruza.
Mugu.
But I'm telling you, that match against Azarenka at Miami, that was the best match, women's match I have seen in, I don't know, years or what. Anyone, find that match on tape and watch it. And then I'm like, wow, when she is like that and she's fired up, she still lost. I think she would have beaten every other player out on tour. That's how good Azarenka is playing, by the way. Now, how do you channel that emotion and that desire to a daily basis? That is going to be the challenge for her team. And this is the part where these players are so young. I just don't think that you want them in the mentality of like, oh, well, that's a like you have to play that tournament. You need to go here. There's money here. This is a mandatory. I think you got to take it easy on this group of players, because sometimes the reasons for playing maybe aren't perfect. And then you get an example where she's out on court with a microphone telling her coach, I don't even want to be out here.
Right.
You cannot have the number three player in the world saying that publicly.
That happened at Indian Wells. This is not a hypothetical example you're giving.
Yeah, that just cannot happen. So the people around her, the WTA, they've got to try and make sure that these players are aware of what's happening, and they can't say that. It looked horrible. Simona Halep.
That one to me is a mystery. What's going on there?
I don't know. It has to be mental, right?
Well, you know, I saw Darren in Australia, and he said, you know, she probably shouldn't even, you know, she had this virus in her nose and she was going to get surgery, and it went to, there are days when she couldn't even get out of bed. And he said, all right, well, we'll give her a pass on Australia, let's hope she clears that up. Then I don't think she had the surgery,
right?
And then sometimes she's looked terrific and looked like, you know, a player who got to number two in the world, and other times she's looked less than terrific, and she doesn't necessarily have great, you know, it's a little bit like Murray. I mean, if you're looking across the net and the other player's getting so upset at seemingly nothing, you're internalizing that. I can't figure her out. I mean, sometimes I think this is a Grand Slam champion, and other times you say, boy, this is a head case you can't bank on to make the second week of a slam anymore.
I know, and she's had some great opportunities too. So, you know, it's interesting with Cahill when he goes out there, because he's very conscious of trying to get her to relax and to smile, and, you know, I think that they're dealing with a lot most of it's mental. She's got a pretty nice looking game. Of course, every player has a few holes, but her belief, it's like she's got to start getting that belief that she can win at the top, and something is holding her back.
These coaches don't always have it so easy. You got to figure out what, and then, I mean, Kvitova is the same boat to some extent.
I guess so. She just looks like she is way better at tennis than she ever thought she would be. She's so incredibly talented, hits the ball so well. She cares about it, but it doesn't strike me that it like keeps her up like late at night. I could be wrong. It could just be the facade she gives off, but she just seems like she really likes to play, and sometimes she plays so well she can't believe it, and other times she doesn't, and it's kind of like, it just seems like she's like, yeah, that's okay. I'll, you know, whatever. I have another tournament. She's just a unique type of personality, I think. I don't know what you think.
What you've described, by the way, doesn't sound a ton different from a certain right-handed American a generation ago from Southern California. No, I think she's a, you know, you talk to her, she's a lovely person, and you have a feeling that she just doesn't have a competition gear that other players do, and sometimes she can win on talent alone and win majors on talent alone, and other times, it's not really going my way today, and it's kind of hot out. I mean, I just...
Yeah, kind of.
She has so much game.
I totally agree. I just... you know, you brought up the Angelique Kerber, right? Now, here's a player that I think works off the charts hard. And, you know, she is very good, but there's certain holes in her game, and right. She fights so hard to protect them. And she can't always do it, and sometimes she can. And that's like, her mentality is so completely different from Kvitova. It's like, it just seems like it's 180 degrees different. Like, I'm just going to do everything I can every day to just maximize my potential, and look what happens. She wins a slam.
I was going to say, she retires tomorrow, and she's a slam winner.
It's amazing.
Let's spare a teeny bit of time for the dudes. The storyline on January 1st would have been who can beat Djokovic.
Yep, and it still is.
I was going to say some bad contact lens issues notwithstanding. I'm not sure we've advanced that topic much. Are you seeing anyone making any inroads?
Doesn't seem like it. Jeez, and now it seems like it's such an incredible high level, and the few matches this year where he hasn't been, he's still just like bawling out there,
right?
Like being a baller, not crying. Just like, okay, I'm gonna figure this out, and he's just so mentally tough. A lot of other players, if they had the last 2 years that he's had, and they're playing a match and they made, I think, was it 100 unforced errors against Simone? Or what was it that day?
In the fourth round of Australia, he hit triple digits in unforced errors.
He was struggling to make balls in the court. It was hot. It was long. Some guys could have walked away or whatever, and this guy's just like never going to do that. And he's doing it at smaller tournaments when he's not playing well. He's just like, nope, not happening today. And that's just amazing, because sometimes you lose your motivation, or you're like, I've gotten to the finals of 18 tournaments in a row. No problem. I'll pack it in this week.
Exactly.
Not happening with him. That is the most impressive thing.
And you go down the list, and you know, Roger is Roger, but he hasn't been Roger this season. And, you know, Nadal had a nice week in Indian Wells, but still hasn't cracked Djokovic. And Murray's head-to-heads against Djokovic haven't been so strong. I mean, you just kind of go down the list and you sort of say to yourself, who exactly is going to mount the challenge here?
Yeah, I know. I agree with you. We'll see. I mean, Kyrgios, he's definitely showing signs in that direction this year. Like, mentally, he seems more engaged. He's got to be able to keep it together every single point in game against Novak. I don't know if he's quite ready for that. Murray's got to get it together, it seems, more emotionally in those big matches. I don't know. It's not like you see Nishikori ascending and starting to dominate Novak.
Right.
But everyone says, we said this like 10 years ago when Roger was at his very best, and along came Rafa and along came Novak. So I'm sure along will come another player that is great, but I don't know who that player is yet.
If you follow sports, you know that always happens that way, right? I mean, they're never going to be another Michael Jordan. Kobe and LeBron are pretty good. But, someone said Novak's about to hit 100 straight matches of 100 straight wins, consecutive wins against younger players.
I didn't know that.
That does not suggest that the castle storming is coming anytime soon, and he's going to be deposed.
So does he win the French?
I think.
Does he end up with more majors than Roger? What do you think?
I think the sheer math, kind of. I mean, you know, who knows? You look at, we would have said that about Tiger in 2008, and he hasn't won a single one since. So who knows? I think the sheer math certainly. I mean, players are playing longer than ever. So, 29, 28, 30 years old is not what it used to be.
Yep, absolutely.
And you don't see a whole lot of resistance coming. Is it crazy that he wins two majors for the next 4 years? I don't know.
It would be crazy to think that he might not win three this year right now, based on
yeah, exactly. Oh, well, oh, if he played, if he won think, okay, if he only wins year. If he only wins two this year, it would be like a remarkable what happened to Novak, what happened to this drop off.
That's where we're at. Is that amazing?
That's crazy.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
I think the other thing that's crazy is, Pete Sampras, best of all time, and we're never going to see another. Enjoy him while it lasts, because it's never going to be another. Roger Federer, greatest of all time. We're never going to see another. Oh, here comes Nadal. Holy shit, he's up to double-digit majors, and Nadal's going to overtake Roger. And then here comes Novak. We may see, we may see four greatest of all times in a period of 15 years.
Yep, it's remarkable. That's why I hope Novak wins the French. I hope he gets the career slam when it's all said and done. That would be a shame.
There would be something cruel.
Do that.
The other irony about that is this guy's a really good clay. I mean, if Pete Sampras never wins the French, you know, or McEnroe, or dare we say, a certain Californian. Novak grew up on. This guy grew up on clay. I mean, it's not as though clay's kind of a reach for him. This guy's a really, really good clay court player. There would be a certain irony to his not winning a career slam, but hitting double figures in majors. Multiple people have suggested when we do these podcasts, we have a tip or two for recreational players, so they can get something out of it. I had lunch with a friend the other day who's he has a young son who's playing it. In Connecticut, actually at the facility, I think, where Gigi Fernandez works.
Mm-hmm.
How do you tell people, whether they're kids or recreational players or whether it's Madison Keys, how do you close a match? I mean, what do you do or don't do differently at 5-2 than you do to start the set?
The basic thing and this is what someone would tell to me, is, okay, so let's say you're receiving for the match. And you're playing someone that has a returnable serve. You're not playing like Milos Raonic, where you're just reacting.
Boy, we're the boys' tens here.
Yes. Know in your mind, before they serve, where you're going with your shot. So it's like, it's just automatic. So the first serve, if it comes to my forehand, I'm going pick up the middle. I'm going cross court. Have a place where you're zeroing in on, try and know what your opponent's weakness is. So like if you're starting to feel nerves and you're like, okay, my opponent's forehand is better. So tell yourself, okay, I'm going to the backhand. I'm just going to the backhand until maybe you have a shot that's mid-court and you can do something with. Take any of the guesswork out, because sometimes people that get real nervous, the ball's coming to them. It's like, oh, I'm going to go cross-court. Or where am I going? I'm going up the line that they don't know. So get all the indecision out of what you're actually going to do with your shot. Second, you got to keep, the deep breaths. You have to try and think like it's the first game. That's the challenge for people. Roger Federer, throughout his career, has managed to look like every game is not the most important game. I don't know how he mastered that, but that's something you have to try and talk yourself into.
All right, that's good. What about when it's 5-2 and suddenly it's 5-4?
Yeah, that's when it starts sucking.
How do you ward off the oh shit, I'm starting this? Can we swear on this?
Go watch Azarenka playing Serena in Indian Wells, because all of us thought she still had major scar tissue left from the previous year, from everything, and to get up 6-4, 5-1, and to come back at 5-4, be serving at 15-40, and look at her. She's not looking like rolling her eyes. She's not like, of course this is happening. She's like digging her heels in, the gnarly look, the fist pumps. Like, she was like, I am battling through this. You are not going to beat me, nerves. You're not going to beat me today.
And look what happened.
Yeah, exactly.
It's interesting you said that about Serena, by the way, just to go back to that. That Vinci match.
What?
That the Vinci match she still hasn't quite gotten over, that there was this investment.
I think that's valid.
I think
that there's been so few things that she has wanted so badly in her career that she hasn't been able to get.
Right.
And so much focus was on it. It was going to be an even bigger game changer for her. I mean, no one's done it since 88. I think she's all about the history books now. I think she knew that would probably be her best and last chance, and just couldn't believe it. Like, if you then step back, like, I had to beat Roberta Vinci and Flavia Panetta to be probably considered the greatest of all time.
Right.
Not that it holds her back from what we think, but it is, that would have been an even bigger game changer.
In a weird, perverse kind of way, it's heartening to know that it would mean that much to her. I mean, I could see Serena being like, all right, you know, out of sight, out of mind, and let's go win the Australian Open.
I don't know.
And train's back on.
I don't think she'd ever admit it.
No,
you know,
no.
She likes to downplay it all, but that's, again, Patrick could laugh, or whoever in her camp would be like, you're so far from the truth. And that could be. It just seems like something broke her spirit, and that seemed to be broken right about the U.S. Open. They say she's very happy in her personal life. I have no idea. A lot of times in the past when some bad results came, it was correlated to some issues going on off the court. It doesn't seem to be the case this time, but who knows?
Let's end here. We can agree that this sport is so much more complex than the little line scores we get on our phones or
that most people know about. Exactly.
A lot going on here. All right, we're encroaching on an hour. I'm taking a lot of your time. As always, you were great. Thanks.
Thank you, guys.
We'll do this. You're turning into our. I think I said. What did I say? Like Alec Baldwin on Saturday Night Live.
I'm not speaking to you till May or June. Okay.
French Open preview. Jamie says. You're done.
That's
for
when
April.
We both picked Simona Halep to win last year.
Yeah, I know. We were roundly criticized, and then we had to eat that one a little bit.
Dang it, Simona.
Milos Raonic is going to win Wimbledon. I've been saying that all year. All right. Thanks, as always. Seriously.
Thank you, guys.
It's a pleasure. Take care. All right. That was Lindsay Davenport, our friend and colleague. I think it's clear why she's so well-liked and well-regarded as a commentator. A lot of candor, a lot of interesting insight, a lot of speculation, which is fine and part of the job. A lot going on in this crazy tennis world, and it is only the first week of April. We'll see whether things settle. We'll see what happens with Maria Sharapova and match fixing and Serena Williams, what I think we can almost now call it something of a slump. We'll see how that all resolves itself. These are the plots that continually move and evolve in tennis. Thanks for listening. As always, comments, suggestions, always welcome. I like a few of you had that idea to have some of our guests talk about recreational tennis issues. That was really good, and I thought Lindsay's answer was great. So suggestions like that are always welcome. We'll be back with another guest next week, and do it again. Have a good week, everyone. Take care. We'll be right back.